And where are you? 238 what?
Avenue.
Avenue Road?
Yes.
In Newmarket?
No, Markham, Markham.
Avenue Road in Markham?
Yes.
238 Avenue Road.
Yes.
Can you spell the junior for me, please?
Dad?
Thank you. Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Good evening.
Today we're talking about the Jennifer Pan story, and we're going to be talking to Jeremy Grimaldi, the author of a new book about this crime that's titled A Daughter's Deadly Deception. Now, the Pan family, they had these really high expectations for their children, and their daughter Jennifer, she took figure skating classes, she played the piano, and she attended Catholic school, where she played the flute in the band. Her parents picked Jennifer up each day at school, monitored her extracurricular activities, and they forbid her from attending school dances or even parties. She wasn't allowed to have a boyfriend, even when she got into high school. Now, it was a very sheltered life, a life some might call oppressive even. But this type of parenting is commonly called tiger parenting, and it's considered kind of the norm in Chinese American families. Now, as Jennifer approached adulthood, though, she began a life of deceit. She forged report card grades and even some college acceptance letters to avoid her parents' disapproval. Then she began to live a double life. She pretended to attend the University of Toronto while spending time with a forbidden boyfriend and working as a waitress. So by the age of 24, Jennifer was living with her parents when her lies were discovered. She was allowed to stay in their home with the agreement that she'd cut all ties with her boyfriend and go back to school. So this is when Jennifer came up with a plan to hire someone to kill her parents. So this shocking story is the subject of crime and justice journalist Jeremy Grimaldi's new book, A Daughter's Deadly Deception. And in this episode of True Crime Brewery, we'll examine Jennifer Pan's deceptions, the brutal crimes that killed her mother and left her father horribly wounded, and the concept of tiger parenting. Also, we talked to Jeremy, as I said, so we'll be able to ask him some questions about the crime because he sat through the whole trial. So before we get to the beer, I'd just like to thank a few 5-star reviewers.
Of course. We can't forget our 5 stars.
No, they're our favorites. So thank you so much. Tom Shelf Tom 18T. Brendan NX. Silver Lining Utilitarian. Vico Erythrin. Bartolome T. Baxter III. Rye 63005. Mindy JJ. Jenna 577. Mrs. Owly Bird. Houston Britt, Ava 99, Michelle Kaufman, F. Joel Muff, Cher Obama, Texas Aggie 95, Jeff 9623712, and Freedom Sings.
You always leave the good ones for the end.
I try and have a good one at the end, yep.
Yeah.
Did you bring us a good beer from Toronto?
Well, I bought you a beer from Toronto, and it's not a particularly good beer. But I feel kind of nostalgic about it.
Okay, so there is something that made it worth reviewing in your mind.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
So what I'm going to review is Molson Canadian Lager.
Oh, now, Molson. I remember Molson.
Molson is now part of the Coors umbrella. So it's brewed by Molson Coors Canada in Toronto. So the fondness that I have for this beer stems from when I was in medical school many years ago. And this passed for craft beer. At that time.
Well, there weren't a lot of choices, right?
There were abysmally small choices. But this was, it was a Canadian beer. So American students that were fortunate enough to live in the Northeast or the northern part of the United States might be able to get this. So it was kind of the Molson mystique. But I remember drinking it and thinking at the time, wow, this is the life.
All right.
So the Molson Canadian Lager is what's considered an American adjunct lager. Now, these are the light-bodied, pale, fizzy beers. They have low bitterness, thin malts, and a moderate alcohol content. They're called adjunct lagers because cereal grains are commonly added to the brewing process to save money. So you're not using all the barley. You're using some rice or some corn. So most people consider these in a derogatory way as lawnmower beers.
Well, including you, right?
I guess I'm a snob in that regard, too. So this is the beer you're drinking when you're out mowing the lawn and you're thirsty.
But a beer always tastes great when you're doing that, so it's not a bad thing.
No. And it's, again, it's very low in alcohol, so you're not going to cut a toe off. by drinking the beer while you're mowing the lawn.
Well, that's always good.
So this particular beer is a pale yellow color, a small white head, not much else going on. It's got a grainy aroma. I can't say much more than that. A corn taste, a little grain, and a very ever so faint touch of hops.
But not hoppy.
No.
Nothing like an IPA.
But they're not supposed to be.
Sure.
So thank you for letting me relive part of my youth, or my, maybe not youth, but younger days with good old Molson Canadian.
Awesome. Okay. Well, let's open it up and we'll head on down.
Let's go.
Okay, Dickie, let's head on down to the quiet end with our Molsons.
Right, and we're going to use the basic pint glass for these.
That makes sense.
And we might as well just bring the whole six-pack, because we can power through them.
Okay, we'll drink right out of the bottle. If you want, just bring the six-pack and what you do when you're mowing the lawn.
Well, that is true. So we could do that, or we could be a little more genteel and pour it into a glass.
Oh, fuck it.
All right.
Let's just drink out of the bottles.
Whoa.
Yeah.
You rebel.
Like they do in Canada, eh?
You gotcha.
All right.
You betcha.
You betcha. That's Fargo.
Oh. All right. Sorry.
That's not Canada. You betcha is Fargo.
Okay.
All right.
I got my idioms straight now.
Okay. So let's go to our story, the Jennifer Pan story. So Big Ha and Han Pan, Jennifer Pan's parents, were Vietnam-born, ethnically Chinese, Vietnamese immigrants to Toronto, Canada. Han was born and educated in Vietnam, and he moved to Canada in 1979 as a political refugee. Vic also immigrated as a refugee, and they married in Toronto. They had two children. Now, Jennifer was born in 1986, and her younger brother Felix in 1989. So they both worked at Magna International, an auto parts manufacturer. Han was a tool and die maker. Vic made car parts. Now, they were very frugal, and they were able to buy a nice house with a two-car garage in a suburb that had a large Asian population. Now, the Pans, they'd saved money, and they had two luxury cars as well. They had a Lexus and a Mercedes. And their main focus in life was to provide an easier life for their children. So they expected their children to get degrees from good colleges and get good jobs.
Well, yeah, I mean, here, this is the common refugee refrain. I mean, we want a better life for our kids than we had.
Well, every parent, really.
Not every parent.
Well, okay. Every parent who wants their kids to do better than they did.
Here we have people that immigrated to Canada, political reasons, political asylum and stuff. I'll bet they had, or at least he had a tough time in Southeast Asia.
Right.
So he wants to make his kids' lives easier for them and better for them.
Yes. So they believed that Jen would be a doctor and Felix would be an engineer. That was what they had planned out for their kids.
Those are good plans.
They even had the professions picked out. So these were grand plans for the children of Han Pan, who left for Canada on a ship that was at sea for months with the threats of disease, starvation, and even pirates. He was 26 with no money and no education in the English language, and Han had met Big Ha briefly back in Vietnam. And then they met up again in Toronto. So they married, and they worked hard, and their main goal was to build this better future for their children. So social mobility was pretty much unheard of back home. But in Canada, they knew that if you worked hard, you could build a better life, so this was an opportunity. So frugality ruled in the Pans' early years in Canada, and they saved to buy their three-bedroom suburban home. Now neither Bic nor Han wanted their children to labor for their money like they did. Their dreams turned to a daughter who's going to go to med school and be a doctor, and a son who's going to be an engineer. So he's not going to be physically building cars, he's going to be designing cars.
Exactly.
He's going to be one of the boss type guys.
And they had already, they had scrimped and saved enough money to move out of a relatively poor neighborhood into a slightly more affluent neighborhood.
Yes, and get these two fancy cars, and it's kind of amazing. Because she was pretty much just a factory worker.
Right.
Neither one of them spoke much English.
They must have been incredibly frugal.
They must have been. They must have pinched those pennies hardcore.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, in Asian cultures especially, the careers of your offspring don't only reflect on the child, but on the parents. And there's a hierarchy of professions. So you have medicine, engineering, and law being at the top. So if your parents were Asian, they'd love you.
Well, they love me anyway.
Your parents love you anyway, yeah. Now, when Jennifer was born in June 1986, they were pleased to give her this English name, Jennifer, but they didn't speak English at home. The family spoke Vietnamese and Cantonese, and they were very kind and loving with Jennifer as a baby. But as she grew older, her parents saw their primary roles as being disciplinarians, especially Han. He saw his role as being the disciplinarian and making sure the kids did what they were supposed to do.
Right. But that's, I mean, the male parent generally is the disciplinarian.
Well, in most cultures.
Right.
Yeah. So emotions in the household were very restrained. And if Jennifer misbehaved, Han and Bick, they showed really some pretty big disappointment when she did something wrong, right? But when she was successful, the praise was very muted. So you didn't get a big reaction for doing something good. But when you did something bad, it was bad.
Right.
There was a bad reaction.
But there's the belief that you don't want to be too praising. Because the theory is that it makes the child complacent.
Yeah, do you think that's true?
No, I think that the more you encourage and praise a child, the more the results will show.
Yeah, but there's a difference between praising and encouraging. And if you praise them for doing mediocre things, well, are they ever going to want to excel?
I didn't say mediocre things.
I know, but I'm just saying.
I just said in general.
In general, yeah.
That it's good to have feedback that your parents are proud of you.
Absolutely. And yes, but I think some American parents might even overdo that.
Well, yeah, but that's a whole other topic.
I know. But okay. You know me, I always like to get whole other topics in. But it's the opposite end of this.
It is, yes.
So that's where you kind of have to find a balance, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Oh, I agree with that.
Okay. So Jennifer spent her childhood trying to make her parents proud. This was important to her. And when she didn't meet their standards, she just tried even harder. Now, she began piano lessons at the age of 4. And then when she was 6, she began competing in youth figure skating. And both of these activities were solitary, and also they weren't chosen by Jennifer. But she did develop a passion for both, especially the piano.
She was quite an excellent pianist.
Yes.
And could have been a concert pianist,
yep,
according to her teachers.
Right, right.
But that's not what the parents had in mind for her.
No, they wanted more.
Right. The piano was kind of a means to the end.
What do you mean?
That you studied piano to become more disciplined, and that reflects on your other endeavors.
Oh, okay. I didn't know about that. I hadn't thought of it that way. Well, when she got to the 9th grade, Jennifer began to get some B's and C's. Although she did continue to excel in music and in math, but faced with the prospect of disappointing her parents and losing any free time that she had been allowed, she started doctoring her report card. And when it worked the first time, she did it again. So the report cards she presented to her father only had A's and A pluses. Anything else was just unacceptable.
And this was getting to be kind of a snowball effect.
Yes, because I think she was telling herself, oh, well, just till next time it'll get better.
Right.
But then it didn't really get better.
All I got to do is get through this semester. Next semester I'll catch up and everything will be fine.
Right.
But it didn't get to be that way.
No.
And she was forced to double down on her lies.
Yes. You dig deeper and deeper with those things.
Yeah.
Now, not only was she banned from dating, but she also wasn't allowed to wear any makeup. She couldn't tweeze her eyebrows. She couldn't color her hair. And in the 10th grade, Jennifer helped raise money with her school band for a trip to Austria. But she was told by her father she couldn't go. But then she finally did convince him to let her go because all the money was raised by her. The teachers said it was going to be safe. She was going to be supervised. It was going to be a learning experience. So eventually he was convinced to let her go. Now, Daniel Wong was in the band, and he went on the trip as well, and he was a year older than Jennifer. Now, he was very different from Jennifer. He was relaxed and fun and known as the class joker. And after the class trip, Daniel and Jennifer stayed in contact. They talked on the phone, they met for lunch, and they flirted between classes. And that summer, she fell in love with Daniel. They spent time together, but of course they kept it a secret. and by the next school year, Jennifer seemed obsessed with him. It seemed to be her only friend, and her grades did not improve. All of her attention, well, not all of it, because she was still playing the piano and ice skating.
And skating.
But he seemed to be her main focus.
Quite a bit.
Yes.
So by the time she got to be 18 years old, and she was a senior in high school, her grades still hadn't improved.
No, so this is 4 or 5 years.
She had continued to forge her report cards, and believing that when she graduated, it would all be behind her. She would go on to college, and her parents wouldn't know about the grades. When she finished college, she'd be able to live her life without her parents' oversight.
Right.
So we can see that. You know, all I got to do is get to this spot, and I'm home free. Except it's not going to work that way.
Well, she really didn't do things that way, though.
No. Nope.
No, she didn't at all.
No, she wasn't able to catch up or get the grades.
So. Well, and you don't have to have great grades to go to college. Plenty of people go to college with average grades.
Right.
But she didn't even want to do it, it seems like. She'd lost the desire or the urge or the motivation, I guess.
I think so. And I think I recall reading when she graduated 8th grade, they had valedictorians for the 8th grade. And she was pretty certain she was going to get it. And she didn't.
So that was a big disappointment for her.
Yeah. And I think that's sort of when she decided, you know, it's not worth working this hard if I don't get rewarded.
Well, maybe, yeah. Good point.
I was just thinking, particularly when I was reading about this in Jeremy's book, that it seemed like that's what had happened.
It's an awful lot of stress, though, to be changing your grades. And yeah. One thing I wondered about was parent-teacher conferences, maybe because of the language barrier her parents didn't attend, because everything would have come to a head there.
Yeah. Or even notes home from school.
Yeah.
So as she went through high school, she improved the quality of her forged reports by professionally designing them. To continue her relationship with Daniel, she lied about her activities and whereabouts. Although she was 18, she had a 9 p.m. curfew. Desperate to be with Daniel, she would sneak him into her room through the rear entrance or second floor window.
Mm-hmm.
At the time when Jennifer should have been preparing to graduate from high school, she failed chemistry and learned she wouldn't be able to graduate with her class. She told her parents she didn't have tickets for them for graduation, and that she presented them with a false diploma. She's working hard. She also produced a false college acceptance and scholarship letter. So yeah. She's set.
Yeah, but why did they believe that? That's the one thing, that she doesn't have tickets for the graduation? That doesn't seem very believable.
Well, it doesn't. But again, I think there's a significant language barrier.
Sure, that's true. But I almost wonder if there was a little bit of denial on the part of the parents.
Possibly.
So Jennifer, she went ahead and purchased books and supplies and really went all out in pretending to go to college classes during the day.
Yeah.
She even spent hours writing out realistic-looking lecture notes to fool her parents.
I'm just impressed as hell with the elaborateness of deceit that she's doing.
I mean, the funny part is, with all that she's doing, she could have just been taking classes and getting a degree. It's so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she began to spend a couple of nights per week with Daniel, and she did that under the pretense of staying with a girlfriend on campus so she could get her studies done and not be interrupted as much. And by this time, she'd convinced her parents that she didn't have the stomach for medical school, so she was going to become a pharmacist. And that was acceptable to her father. So while supposedly completing her pharmacy degree at the University of Toronto, Jennifer told her parents that she was starting work as a volunteer at Toronto's Hospital for Sick Children, which was known as Sick Kids. But Han and Bic Pan were getting suspicious finally. I mean, Jennifer didn't have a hospital ID, she didn't have scrubs, and they followed her to work, and this is when they finally figured out she was lying. So Han wanted to throw Jennifer out of the house, but Bic persuaded him to give Jennifer another chance. So eventually, Jennifer began working to finish her high school diploma, and her parents helped her to reapply to colleges. But Jennifer was forbidden to go anywhere except to her piano teaching job and to school. So the relationship with Daniel was definitely out.
Right. She had to give him up.
Yes. But she didn't really do that.
Of course not.
Now, she wasn't allowed to be in contact with Daniel Wong, the boyfriend, and her cell phone was held by her mother. But her mother would allow her a couple of minutes a day to check her voicemails. So this is kind of silly to me.
Well, yes. Yeah,
you think? But, she's an adult.
Yeah, but it's not our culture.
Yes, I guess so. Now, when Daniel began to pull away from Jennifer and dated another woman, she became very needy and desperate. She invented stories to keep his attention and concern. Once she even told Daniel that several men had broken into her home and gang raped her, just to get his attention. So she's getting kind of sick, getting very obsessed and not a well girl.
No. And I think this is where she starts hatching the plan that if she got rid of her parents, things would improve.
Yeah. So in spring of 2010, Jennifer was in contact with a high school friend named Andrew Montmayer, who introduced her to a goth kid named Ricardo Duncan. And Jennifer paid Ricardo $1,500 to kill her father in the parking lot at his place of work. But then Ricardo, he just kept the money and didn't do the killing, so that was good, right?
Well, it's good that he didn't do the killing.
Yes.
He ripped her off.
So Jennifer was seeing Daniel again in the summer, and they came up with a plan to hire a professional hitman to kill both of her parents. And I don't know why it ended up being both of her parents.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Because it seemed like her mother was pretty easygoing and just kind of following the father's lead.
Yes.
Yeah. So she'd calculated that she would inherit $500,000 if her parents died, and then also she would be free to be with Daniel. So that's a whole other dark side. This is not just trying to get out from under the control of her parents. This is trying to have them killed for money.
Right.
Pretty bad.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah. So Daniel, he connected Jennifer with Lenford Crawford. So this is a man who's known in the book as Homeboy. And from his experience selling marijuana, Daniel had made some friends who were involved in the criminal world. Daniel gave Jennifer an iPhone and a SIM card so she could communicate with Lenford Crawford without using her own personal cell phone. Now, the murders of Jennifer's parents were initially planned for November 3rd, but Jennifer called it off when she learned that they were going out that evening. So on November 8th, Jennifer unlocked the front door of the family home at bedtime. Then she called Lenford Crawford's friend, David. And just minutes later, Lenford, David, and Eric Carty entered the Pan home, and they each had a gun. And the plan was for the three to enter the home and kill Han and Bick in what would look like a random home invasion. So Han and Bick were held at gunpoint and asked to turn over money to the men. But Han, he saw Jennifer calmly speaking with one of the gunmen as she was led upstairs. So Han knew. So I wonder how much Han knew about his daughter, because he seemed to know when this happened that she was in on it, which is a horrible thing.
Oh, isn't it? But I don't know that he knew beforehand.
Before they got there?
Yeah.
Well, he must have known some things, because it's a big jump to go to a daughter you totally trust and think loves you, to saying, oh, she's in on it. It would take more than just her talking to them for me.
I don't know. You know, he's watching her calmly talking with the guy. She should be terrified. She should be running away, trying to escape, all sorts of things.
Right.
So I'm looking at my daughter calmly talking to masked gunmen. I'm thinking she's involved.
Well, I guess I would think she's involved, but I wouldn't think she wanted to kill us. I think maybe she's involved with having something stolen from us.
Okay.
But it would be hard to think your own daughter's going to kill you.
Well, that would be.
But
I think that's what he was realizing.
I think so, which must have been really horrific for him.
Yeah.
Now, Jennifer, she was bound to the upstairs banister as her parents were led downstairs, and a blanket was put over their heads. Now, Bick, she was shot in the head and killed, and Han miraculously survived. He was shot 3 times, I believe, 1 time right in the face. Now, Jennifer, she called 911, which we heard at the beginning of this episode, her 911 call, which I see, I feel some kind of falseness in her voice. Doesn't it seem a little put on to you in some parts?
It was quite emotional.
Yeah.
So
you believed it?
I, you know, just listening to it, hadn't heard it before. Yeah, I think it was a believable phone call.
Okay.
But it didn't last long, the believability.
No. Well, she had her flip phone in the back of her yoga pants and said she was able to reach it behind her and call 911. The police actually had her later on show how she'd done that.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, I could see how she probably could have pulled it out, but Why would they tie her up so loosely? Like she had like 6 to 10 inches of leeway.
Yeah.
And why were they so kind to her and so violent with the parents? It didn't make any sense.
Not in the least.
No. So Han, he woke up downstairs bleeding profusely and noticed that his wife was dead beside him. And he ran out front for help, so he could hear Jennifer yelling. But he didn't go to look for her or talk to her, so he obviously knew that she was in on it. And he ran outside to get help from the neighbor. Now, once he was hospitalized, though, he was put in a medically induced coma, as his gunshot wounds in his head were repaired. So he wasn't able to speak to police right away.
No.
But police were suspicious of Jennifer from the start. They interviewed Jennifer at 3 a.m. that night, and she told them that the men had entered the house looking for money. They'd tied her to the banister, and they'd taken her parents to the basement and shot them. And 2 days later, the police brought her in for the second time to give a statement. So she was interviewed, I think, 3 times before she actually caved in and kind of gave away some things.
Yeah.
Although she never really took responsibility.
No, she didn't.
No.
And, there were holes in her story from the start about what had happened.
Right, and what were they?
So she did show them how she had contorted her body to get to her phone. But that's a little suspicious in itself.
Why? Because she could move around?
Because she could, right.
Yeah. And because they let her keep the phone, that would be unusual.
Right. And then a couple other things. Why would these suspects kill 2 people and leave her unharmed?
Well, they said it was because she was nice to them and they liked her.
Right. That's just bull. The keys to Han's Lexus were in plain view by the door. Why didn't they take the car? How did they get in without forced entry?
Well, I mean, not every robber wants to take a car, so that I could see. But how they got in was very suspicious.
Right. Why was the door unlocked? Why was Jennifer tied up with string from her mother's sewing box?
Yeah, I guess it was a shoelace.
Her shoelace?
Her shoelaces.
Yeah, why didn't they bring zip ties or rope or something?
Yeah, why didn't they bring their own stuff? True.
By November 12th, so this is 4 days, 3-4 days afterwards, Han had woken up from his coma, had a broken bone near his eye, bullet fragments in his face, and a shattered cervical vertebrae. But he remembered everything, including 2 disturbing things about Jennifer.
Hmm.
First, she had been moving through the house untied, and second, she had been speaking softly, like a friend, with one of the intruders.
Well, that's highly suspicious, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that gets back to what I was thinking, that, you know, she's just walking around pretty calm.
Yeah, that makes no sense.
No.
Now, on November 22nd, Jennifer was brought in for the 3rd interview, and the detective, William Gates, felt certain that Jennifer had been involved in the crime. So for almost 4 hours, Jennifer was interviewed this time, and she explained that the attack had been a plan for her to commit suicide. So this was kind of her last-ditch effort to come up with an alternate story.
The last lie.
Yeah, because they had text messages between these people.
Yeah.
So she tried to claim that she'd hired them to kill her because she'd really given up on life, but she didn't have the guts to kill herself. So she'd hired Homeboy, Lenford Crawford, to do it for her. But in September, she said, her relationship with her father had improved, and she decided to call off the hired suicide, I guess you'd call it. But she said somehow their wires got crossed, and the men ended up going after her parents.
Totally unbelievable.
It was. So police didn't believe it.
No, and they have phone conversations.
They do, some very disturbing ones.
Right.
Very, yeah. They arrested her for murder and for attempted murder of her father. And by spring of 2011, after elaborate analysis of cell phone calls and texts, I mean, this was some of the most elaborate work I've seen on cell phone analysis and texts because right. they'd bought alternate phones.
Yeah.
So they were trying to be quite tricky. But they'd gotten hold of phone call and text records from Daniel, from David, from Eric Carty, from Lenford Crawford. And they were all arrested, so all 5 were charged with first-degree murder, attempted murder, and conspiracy to commit murder. But Daniel hadn't been at the house.
No.
No.
But he was kind of the organizer.
Right. So who was actually at the house of these guys? It was David, Eric, And Lenford?
No, Lenford wasn't. The other guy was. Rick.
Oh, and Rick was there. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But who was the shooter? Do we know?
Don't know. They all had guns.
They all had guns. Okay. So the trial began on March 19th of 2014, and it lasted nearly 10 months. Now more than 50 witnesses testified and more than 200 exhibits were filed. Jennifer was on the stand for 7 days. So she desperately tried to convince the jury that while she had ordered a hit on her father in late August of 2010, the original one, 3 months later she changed her mind because their relationship had improved and she'd seen the light.
Allegedly.
Yep. So before the verdict was read, Jennifer Pan seemed almost happy, which was strange. She was kind of playfully chatting with her attorney, and when the guilty verdict came, she showed no emotion. But then once the press left the courtroom, she cried and began shaking uncontrollably. So what does this say about her personality, that she's able to look so stoic or almost happy, and then when people leave, she kind of lets go?
Well, it says that she's a narcissist.
You think so?
Yeah.
Okay. To be able to kind of behave different ways.
Absolutely.
So for first-degree murder, Jennifer was given a life sentence with no chance of parole for 25 years. And for the attempted murder of her father, she got another life sentence to be served concurrently. So.
She's in jail for a time.
Yes. Now, Han and Felix wrote victim impact statements. And Han said, when I lost my wife, I lost my daughter at the same time. I don't feel like I have a family anymore. Some say I should feel lucky to be alive, but I feel like I am dead too. I hope my daughter Jennifer thinks about what has happened to her family and can become a good, honest person someday. Now, Han, he suffers from anxiety attacks, insomnia, and nightmares. He has constant pain from his injuries. He lives with relatives because he can't stand to be in the house where his wife was killed. Now, he's desperate to sell the house, but he can't. I guess no one will buy it. It's a primarily Asian neighborhood, and many in that culture are too suspicious to live in a house where a murder occurred.
Sure, it has bad karma or something, right?
Right, right. So Felix, Jennifer's little brother, he moved to the East Coast, and he works with a private technology company. And he also moved because he wanted to escape the stigma of being part of Jennifer Pan's family. I mean, I'm sure that's a heavy stigma.
Oh, for sure.
Now, Jennifer, she was actually served with a non-communication order by the court. And that was requested by her family as well for 20 years. So she isn't allowed to even attempt to contact anyone in her family for 20 years. So I've never heard of something like that. Have you?
No, it's...
Maybe that's a Canadian thing.
I haven't heard of that ever.
No.
Huh.
Yeah. Well, let's get to our interview with Jeremy, and because he literally wrote the book on this topic.
Yes, he did.
How are you doing, Dick?
I'm fine, Jeremy. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're excited. We read your book. We really liked it.
Oh, really? Great.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we thoroughly enjoyed your book, The Daughter's Deadly Deception.
What did you think about Jennifer?
Wow. She's a piece of work.
Isn't she, though?
Yeah.
Yes. But I, you know, the thing I really liked about it was you presented the crime and the trial and afterwards, and then went into looking at her backstory. And
that's been kind of divisive, actually.
We like that.
Many people liked it and many people didn't. So,
well, different people like different things. I mean, we do that a lot on our podcast. We talk about people's childhoods and backgrounds, and we think that's important.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was very important, especially in Jennifer's case.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that struck me was that she came across somewhat sympathetically. And,
mm-hmm.
And did you kind of feel sorry for her?
Yes and no. It really depends on where in the book you are, I guess. At times, I mean, I definitely feel like we're all products of our environment.
Absolutely.
But then at the same time, she just goes so overboard. it's hard to feel sympathy for her at the end, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
But
so I kind of waver between the both. What do you two think?
Well, as I was reading the book, and getting into her upbringing and the whole thing about her parents and the tiger parenting and that kind of stuff, I did feel sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
But then a lot of her friends said, well, we had a worse time with our parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was left unsure.
Well, exactly. And, you know, she did have loving parents, I would say.
Yeah, that's true as well. I wondered how the reader was going to react being left unsure, because I figured a lot of people would be left unsure. And I didn't know, you know, I would tend to believe most people would want to either love her or hate her. But being left unsure sort of leaves you hanging a bit. I don't know if that's good or bad.
I don't know. I mean, I really, at the end, I pretty much hated her.
Oh, really?
I thought she was pretty evil. It seemed like it was all about her, and why didn't she just leave if she was that miserable?
Yeah, for sure. That's the way I feel at the end of the book, yeah.
Yeah.
But then earlier when I was writing, I was thinking I had some sympathy for her.
Sure, yeah.
It really depends, but I really like how people can have either one feeling or the other.
Yes.
That I enjoy.
Yeah.
Well,
so how did you come to write this book?
I became the crime reporter at my newspaper and started covering this trial. And at the end of it, I became sort of the go-to guy. and realized that someone had to write this story. And it kind of fell to me. And I knew if I didn't do it, no one would do it. So I sucked it up and spent a year of my life doing it.
Wow.
So you live in Toronto?
I live in Toronto, yes.
And you cover crimes and stuff in all of Canada or Eastern Canada?
So,
or
actually, in the suburbs above Toronto, a place called York Region.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a quite an affluent suburb. It includes about 10 to 13 cities and towns. So you see a lot of the crime there is very particular. It's a lot of middle class crime. So a lot of domestic issues. There's a lot of mental health issues,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes associated with people having a bit more money. I mean, there's been 6 parasites since 2010 when Jennifer killed
wow.
him. Yeah.
Just, oh, my God.
Just in your region?
Yeah, and there's only 1 million people there.
Wow.
So it's,
Is there an ethnic division in this with the killing of parents? Or
I can't, there's definitely an ethnic division, but the region is very, very diverse and not diverse at the same time. Because there are towns that, like Markham, that have 50% one race. And then there's a town right beside it that is 40% Italian. And then there's a town that's 40% Jewish. And then there's a town that's 30% Russian. So it's very diverse, but there are pockets of culture.
Well, that explains a lot, because they said that the neighborhood where the Pans lived was primarily Asian, so they were in a pocket.
Yeah.
Okay.
They tend to once they start making money, they move north a lot of the times. So a lot of times they just move north of where the pockets were originally.
Okay.
Those are the more affluent neighborhoods. And so for example, the Italians lived in a certain pocket north Toronto, and they just moved north from there. And the same with the Asians living in a neighborhood and then moving north to Markham.
Huh, that's really interesting.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess they're upwardly mobile.
I guess so.
Literally.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So did you actually sit through the trial?
Yeah.
Jennifer? You did.
Yeah, it was long. And there were a lot of
questions. It was long.
Yes, it was extremely long.
And it looked like during the trial that there wasn't much sympathy for her.
No, there was. She was a very disliked person. And it went even deeper because of the deception. You know, doing that to your parents and then pretending like you're a victim is almost beyond the pale for a lot of people, I'd imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she almost, I thought her voice almost sounded a little fake in the 911 call, actually, after reading the book and then listening to her 911 call.
Yeah.
It sounded kind of phony, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah, it did. And it was also interesting how she sort of vacillated between worrying about herself and worrying about her mother. You know, and that's what leaves a lot of people wondering whether she's a sociopath or not, and mm-hmm. and whether she actually, how much she actually regretted it.
Does she have a psychiatric diagnosis?
Actually, she probably did, but it wasn't submitted, presumably because it turned out to be negative. But there was probably one done for her by her lawyer.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I public. Just kind of pegged her as a narcissistic personality type of person.
Yeah. Yeah. I would peg her as that. I know there's one part of the book where somebody divulged to me part of her mental health, her private medical records, which are extremely private in Canada. I'm sure they're the same in the United States. Mm-hmm. And said that when she saw a therapist at one point, she was more worried about what the newspapers were saying about her than her mother's death.
Right.
Or her father recuperating from a coma.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt about her. She was more worried about what people thought of her than really yeah. about caring about her parents at all.
Yeah. And that, it was hard for me to, take that on because I guess I'm a bit of an idealist. About human beings, I believe in the best that human beings, and especially when it comes to women, I don't see much aggression in them in terms of committing murders. It's very, very rare that from my standpoint that a female would do something like this, and especially not to be prompted by her boyfriend, because I truly believe that she was the mastermind. Not Shoot. Daniel.
Yeah, I do too, because he was kind of backing away from her, it seemed like.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the other part of it. I mean, they were all on trial together, except for one whose lawyer dropped out. But was there sympathy, or maybe not sympathy, but did the guys in the proceedings get viewed differently than Jennifer? Were they looked at as pawns of hers?
I don't think so, only because that's why I thought it was so important to write the book, because the story, you know, when you're covering the trial, you kind of have to cover Day's testimony, and a lot of the underlying issues or how responsible she was or wasn't couldn't be covered because it's sort of day to day testimony. You can't cover the whole story, so a lot of people weren't even aware of the extent of her activities until the book came out. And there was also an article from a friend of hers after the murder where people started to see who Jennifer really was.
Yes, I think I read that article. It was in the York Region paper. Is that what it was?
The York Region paper is mine. It was in Toronto Life.
Okay, yep. I think I did read that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's quite popular.
Yes, yeah.
So was Jennifer that bright of a kid?
Yeah, that's one thing I wondered.
I shouldn't say kid.
Of a woman. Do you think she had trouble keeping up with the expectations of her parents? That's kind of what made me feel kind of sorry for her in the beginning, is maybe it was just too tough for her to meet their expectations. Or do you think she just kind of didn't care and gave up?
I think both. I definitely don't think she didn't care. I think she cared a lot. But she always had trouble meeting their expectations and then eventually gave up. But the thing about their expectations, for me was that when she finally decided to stop focusing on achieving what they wanted for her. She was so intent on not disappointing them. So they had ingrained in her a sort of hypervigilance in terms of never letting them down. And I think that may have even played a role in their murder in a really twisted way, that she knew that she could never meet their expectations, and so she almost felt it may be better for me to kill them because I'm never going to be able to make them happy.
You know, I think that's a really good point, because I also think the way they were killed, she didn't want them to know when they died.
Yeah.
She didn't want to disappoint them then even.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point.
But it's almost surreal to say it, because it's unbelievable at
twisted,
the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, very twisted.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I think this is the part of the problem with narcissism and sociopaths, narcissists and sociopaths, is that, you know, when people have mental health issues, you tend to feel sorry for them. However, or look into their background to see, you know, where it developed, why it developed. However, when it's a narcissist or a sociopath, you lose a lot of that sympathy because they're actually doing it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But, it's all about you.
Yeah. And first of all, it's odd that Jennifer, if she was a sociopath or a narcissist, first of all, it's usually men who become like this. And second of all, if she did become like that, it dampens your sympathy a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think so. But I think you're right. I think it's very rare for a young woman to do something like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just one final thing about her intelligence. I mean, when I was reading your book, it struck me that when she wasn't chosen valedictorian in her eighth grade class, that was kind of a signal to her that she wasn't going to be as good as her parents thought she was going to be. And she hit high school and started screwing around.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I do think she's a very, very intelligent person. And very wily.
Right.
Wily, yeah. Yeah.
I'd say sly.
Sly.
Sly is another good term for it.
Yeah, but I think when she started faking her grades, maybe she thought she could just do that. Oh, I found an easy way to please them.
Well, those were elaborate fabrications. I mean,
yeah.
As you said, she paid a fair amount of money to fake a diploma from college. I mean,
yeah.
Did she? She bought one. I don't remember that. Yeah.
I mean, it was like $500 or something. It was an insignificant amount of money to keep this facade going.
Well, that brings up another question. Where did she get the money? Because I know she gave some money to these guys, right? And
yeah, well, she was the money. She was working at some point, but she, you know, that whole time she was supposed to be in university, she was actually working. And her mother was also giving her a lot of money.
Oh, really?
We don't know how much, but she was sort of feeding her money, and it was going allegedly to books or, you know, university expenditures, but it wasn't. So we don't really know where the money went.
So the parents might have paid for their own killing.
Yeah.
Contributed to it. Jeez.
Quite ironic.
Yeah, right. But she did buy some books and things, because she actually wrote notes and things to make it look like she was doing schoolwork.
Yeah. Yeah. She was a very diligent liar.
Mm-hmm.
She went to Staples and bought loads of supplies and began fabricating her notebook. So she was writing notes, she was highlighting portions, she was she was creating anecdotes in her head about the days, the school day, her upcoming exam, her frosh week, one of the most striking things about the lies is that she would have had to keep those in her head. So whenever her parent asked her about, you know, how are you doing in pharmacology class, she would she may have to remember the professor's name that she had invented, or whatever. And that right there, I reckon could drive a person mad. get that.
Yeah. Do you think she knew that eventually this was all going to come crumbling down, or did she figure she could continue it indefinitely?
Well, I as part of the book, I did some research into deception. And I heard a great quote today that a lie is sweet in the beginning and bitter in the end, and the truth is bitter at the beginning and sweet in the end.
Hmm. And I like that. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's nice. And I did some research on deception, and it turns out that the younger you are, the more easily you lie on a whim without knowing what's going to happen in the future and not caring.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only when you get older and more mature that you begin to understand consequences, of those lies. So the only thing I can say about that is that she was very immature, even as a 24-year-old. Her lawyer said she had the maturity level of a 15-year-old.
That's true. I forget that she was 24 because I do think of her as being a teenager, the way she acted.
Well, and the way she looks. She looks like a teen.
Yeah.
Yeah, that as well. So I dare say that, she was lying, not even thinking about getting away with it, just carrying on the lie, just thinking day to day or hour to hour, not
planning ahead.
Yeah. Do you think how much do you think was because of the boyfriend, trying to keep the boyfriend?
I think a lot.
Yeah.
I reckon her mental health issues became quite loud in her mind when he wasn't around. And, she kept saying that he keeps me calm. And I also think that, there was some ties between the lack of emotion or feeling or comfort she got from her father as a child and her need for her boyfriend.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's absolutely true, as she really needed his attention.
Yeah.
She was desperate for it in the end there.
For sure. Well,
even when they broke up, they weren't broken up.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it seemed like when he'd try and back away, she'd get a little obsessive, right? She'd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those lies she came up with were, you could see that they kept getting grander and grander and more desperate.
Yeah, because she started lying to the boyfriend about things to get his attention as well.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Because didn't she tell him that she was raped at some point?
Yes. Yeah. And it got to the point where she was gang raped in her own house. She was being followed.
Wow.
It got really extravagant.
So the other thing I was wondering about was her brother, Felix. And it seemed like he's a male. So I think that's an important distinction. But he seemed to escape a lot of the parental stuff that Jennifer is going through.
Yeah, I think that occurs in a lot of ethnicities. I mean, even Western culture to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
He was a bit of a golden boy, but I think they had more hope for Jennifer in a weird way because she had the drive,
Mm-hmm.
She was also much stronger than he was.
Oh, okay. What was the age difference between the two?
I believe three to 4 years. I believe three. But, he dropped out of piano when he was 11, and she was one of the best piano players at the conservatory.
Yeah, you portrayed her as a fairly gifted piano player.
Yeah, she was.
And she could have actually done something with that.
Yes, she could have been a concert pianist or what she ultimately wanted to be was a piano teacher.
Right, and she was quite capable of that. She was doing some of that, wasn't she?
Yeah, Yeah, for sure.
But that's not what the parents expected.
But, you know, they wanted her to be a doctor, and then they accepted that maybe she'd be a pharmacist, so. And then didn't they eventually accept that she was going to be, like, a med tech or something much lower she was in school for eventually?
Yeah, that's when the father got pretty desperate.
Yeah.
I think things were going pretty out of control.
I'll take anything. Just go to school.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and another interesting part of this that she could have actually just not wanted to go to school because she was signed up to go back to school in January.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
With her parents or her mother in November.
That's right, yeah.
She may have just been dead set, excuse the pun, on not going back to school.
Boy, that would be brutal if that was the reason, huh?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So you think there was any truth to this, oh, I'm hiring them to kill me that because I'm suicidal story that she gave? No.
No. It just sounds like another one of her lies. I mean, one of the most interesting part for me is that she's still lying. Even to this day. She's refused to face her demons, since she started lying at age 14 and she still continues to this day.
Do you have any contact with her now?
No, she hates me.
Because you wrote that book.
Well, look at her picture on the front of his book. She doesn't look good.
I wish I could speak to her. But I mean, having said that, she would just lie to me as well. So
yeah,
true.
I don't know. Maybe it's best we don't speak. But it was hard spending 2 years of my life immersed in this person's existence, and then never to engage with her.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like all of a sudden you're cut off.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, having said all that, her friend told me that she's extremely normal if you just meet her.
Mm-hmm.
She's the most normal person you'll ever meet. And so maybe, you know, maybe if I did meet her, it would sort of the mirage would tumble down, but maybe then again, maybe she'd just be still lying to me. So I don't know. I'm a bit ambivalent about that whole thing.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about Daniel Wong and the other guys? Do you think that they were equally responsible? You said that she was the mastermind.
Yeah. A lot of people feel sorry from the feedback I've received, a lot of people felt sorry for Lenford Crawford.
Okay.
And who is also known as Homeboy in the story.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel Wong, who by all intents and purposes is sort of a video game nerd. You know, a pudgy, four eyes, seemed like everyone I spoke to said he was one of the best guys they've ever met. So I feel bad for him in a way. I mean, but it is also, you know, he was an adult and a very naive person, and he did something that resulted in someone's death. So,
right. Well, do you think that Jennifer and Daniel could have both just been naive young people that didn't really understand the seriousness of what they were doing?
Yes, I do think. I know they didn't have. I mean, Daniel had some street smarts, but they didn't have much of a social life, either of them, really.
Mm-hmm.
They were quite sheltered from a relatively strict Asian home. So them being naive at age 24, I would say is probably quite accurate. You know, they didn't go to university. They never lived outside their home.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back, you know, I'm 39 now, you know, at 24, you think you're kind of all grown up, but looking back, you realize how stupid you were and how little you knew about anything.
Oh, yeah, and how close you came to ruining your own life many times.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I, had many times when I was writing this book.
Yeah, and I think that's the only sympathy I have kind of comes from that direction of youth and foolishness. And
yeah.
Well, up to a point.
Well, you're kind of a hard ass because I do feel some sympathy.
You know, I'd love to think that it was all Jennifer's fault and she coerced these guys into doing it, or coerced Daniel into...
Because Daniel, he wasn't actually there, right?
He wasn't.
So I always kind of wonder about people who aren't actually there. Would they actually do it if they were there? Because having the idea is a little different than actually doing it.
Oh, yeah. I don't think Daniel or Lenford would have it in them to pull the trigger.
Right.
Yeah.
But they get the same punishment.
Yes, exactly. Is it the same in the United States?
Yes, actually, we're doing an episode next month on felony murder where kids that have just loaned their car to someone have gotten the same sentence as someone that borrowed their car and murdered someone because, you know, they're an accessory.
Whoa, that's not the same in Canada, that portion.
No, we're more all-encompassing.
We like to lock people up here.
Yeah, I know that part.
Yeah.
But that sounds pretty unfair.
Oh, yeah, there are plenty of cases like that.
Wow.
Yeah. So I always wonder about that. If people agree to do it, they're not actually doing it. Should they really get the same punishment?
Yeah. Does it matter if they know what the person's going to do?
Well, I think in theory it does, but sometimes...
But not in practice.
Sometimes no. Sometimes it's been... I mean, of course, there's a lot of details to it, but it can be being in the car with someone who does something. It can be... There was one guy who actually just loaned his car to someone to go... Well, you know what it was? He loaned them his car so they could go buy pot, but they went there and they were robbing for pot. And then if you kill someone while in a robbery, it's felony murder. So someone ended up getting killed. So the kid that gave him the car to go get pot was just as guilty. So it was just like five times removed, but still the same punishment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be an interesting show.
Yeah. Yeah. It will be. So, I think there was one more thing I wanted to ask you. Oh, what about interrogation technique? Now, didn't they lie to Jennifer? Because
they
I know
did.
Some policemen do that, and it's legal to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, how do you feel about that?
Good question. I don't know how I feel about that. I think a lot of people who were attending the trial were quite upset about it, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
It definitely put the police in a negative light, and a lot of people were of two minds, I would imagine, about their activities. And but then, having said that, I also realized that, you know, criminals will often do anything within their power to avoid being caught, and fair enough. So I think the police need some sort of ability to play, make the playing field level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I spoke to a couple police officers about this, and one of them off the record said, you know, most of these guys will sell their mothers down the river. They'll do anything. They'll lie, steal, and sometimes murder to get out of to get out of charges. So In those circumstances, I think it would be difficult for police if they didn't lie.
Because it's kind of levels the playing field, do you think, if they're allowed to lie?
Yeah, because the people are going to lie to them.
Sure.
But it's difficult because I don't know if you've seen I'm sure you have, Making a Murderer.
That is in my notes, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, because that Brandon Massey.
Yeah.
He was only a teenager. Now,
yes.
I think that was an extreme case of that, though.
Yes, but and he was also, I guess, a bit slow.
Yes, right. Low IQ.
Yeah, and I mean, this isn't the case in Jennifer's situation at all.
No, and she was 24.
And she's quite bright.
Right,
But Brendan, you know, went along with what the grown-ups were telling him.
Yeah, that one was hard to watch. That made me sick.
It was difficult, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, they were really leading him down a path. And, well, that brings up also minors being interviewed without a lawyer or a parent, which is illegal in Europe, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I did learn a bit about that, because I know in certain countries that technique, where the officer will present what he believes occurred is illegal in certain countries,
mm-hmm.
because of that, because of a false confession.
Right, right. Yeah, but I think I agree with you there about Jennifer, but totally different with the Making a Murderer. That one was tough to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So are you working on another book now? What are you doing now?
I'm relaxing, really. This book took a pretty big toll on my life and my wife.
Yeah, and you have two little kids there that I see in your picture. Yeah.
Yeah. and my family, so I'm relaxing, but I mean, I have another story in mind, and, so whenever that kind of comes to trial, you never know, right? But I know when I was writing it, when I was writing this book, I kept saying to myself, I'm never going to do this again, and I can't wait till it's over.
But then it's over, and you say, okay, I can do another one.
I kept comparing it to pregnancy, even though I've obviously never experienced it. But it's kind of like, it's hell while you're doing it, but it's heavenly when it's over.
And it took you about a year?
A year, yeah. A year to write it, and a year covering it in the trial.
Wow.
Yeah.
I could see why you'd want to break after that.
Yeah, for sure, because it's such an effed up story, excuse my language, but, you know, you're caught up in this crazy woman's life, this crazy family's life for 2 years, and it's kind of all you think about.
Yeah, is that what you would talk about at dinner with your wife? You'd say, oh, Jennifer, this?
No, I didn't go.
Did you get sick of hearing it?
No, I didn't. I sort of internalized it all, because I don't know. I told her, because it was just, I'm still grappling with it, really. I always encourage, every interview I do, I encourage people to get in touch with me to talk about it once they've read the book. I really love to hear what people think about Jennifer, and, you know, similar to what we spoke about, whether you have sympathy for her or you think she's the devil reincarnate or what. So I always tell people to email me.
Well, I think that the way you did it, I do go back and forth. I vacillate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a good part.
Good to hear. That's what I was trying for.
Yeah, that's great. You accomplished that for sure.
Cool.
Yeah, I went up and down and up. I mean, the beginning, you say, okay, She's the devil, and then you read some sympathetic stuff, but at the very end, I'm saying she's the devil.
Yeah.
Yeah, the text messages at the end there with Jennifer and Daniel going back and forth right hours before the murder are very troubling.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you can definitely tell she's the mastermind at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, she's definitely leading him by the, I don't know what you call it, nose.
Yeah.
Nose is good.
Nose is a good thing to say. Yeah.
Well, we enjoyed your book. We hope you keep writing.
Oh, thanks very much. It's really amazing to hear that people so far away are reading and enjoying the book. It really makes my heart sing.
Well, good job. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. And then if you start working on another case, we'd love to hear from you.
I will contact you. By then you'll be, you know, you'll have 2 million listeners every week.
Well, yeah, you'll have to call our people by that.
Yeah,
that's right.
We won't be taking our own calls. Come on. Have your people call our people.
Yeah, for sure.
But we certainly appreciate you giving up some of your evening to do this.
I love talking about this kind of stuff.
We do too.
Yeah, great.
Well, we'll talk to you later.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Good night.
Yeah, you too.
Well, it really surprised me that Jeremy really had some sympathy for Jennifer in...
Well, at times.
At times, right.
I mean, I think what he said was he didn't end up feeling sympathy for her. There were times when he had some sympathy.
Well, I think he had a hard time believing that a young woman was capable of this kind of thing. And
well,
it is rare.
There's that. And there's also... I think that it's probably not the easiest thing in the world being raised by a tiger parent.
Yeah.
If you're a kid, and they demand so much excellence, it can really be tough on a child.
Yeah, well, it's probably the same thing with like a child star, things like that, any kind of kid that's encouraged to succeed.
No, I think there's certainly other analogies.
Yeah.
But You know, I read parts of Amy Schwa's book about tiger parenting, and it was a difficult thing to read. I mean,
well, because some of them had much tougher time than Jennifer did.
Yeah, we heard that a lot, that other Asian kids were saying, oh, my parents were worse than that.
Yeah, and I didn't kill them, so there.
Yeah, right.
Right.
So I think there's some sympathy to be there for Jennifer in terms of her upbringing. But ultimately, you're right. I mean, you're not necessarily planning on killing your parents.
Well, no. And the thing is, she wasn't a teenager. She was 24. And I keep forgetting that because of her behavior. But right. She was well into adulthood.
She was. I mean,
she didn't even have to stay there. She could have been out on her own.
The pictures of her, she looks like a 15-year-old.
Well, she's petite, but still, that doesn't really matter what she looks like. She was 24.
Yeah.
Right?
She was.
Yeah. So, I do kind of, maybe you have more sympathy for a person, too, when you see them every day in court. You can see it more as a real person.
You get familiar with them.
Do you think you'd enjoy sitting through a case like that, or would you get bored?
I think I would be looking for the end of the trial. This thing lasted, what, 10 months?
Yeah, a long time.
I don't see how I could sit through 10 months of trial.
I mean, well, if you're a juror, you have to do it and you don't even really get paid.
Right. But as a spectator, I mean, that's another reason to admire Jeremy. He stuck with it the whole way.
Sure. But his job. I mean, a lot of people who went to OJ and Casey and all these huge trials did it willingly. I don't understand that.
Oh, I don't understand that
at all. I kind of feel like you can't have much of a life if you're out doing that, unless you're reporting on it or doing something with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I will bet there were times when Jeremy was probably bored out of his mind.
Probably.
And times when he was riveted with the testimony.
Yeah, I guess it depends on the day and the testimony, but he had to report each day on what was being said.
Right.
Regardless of how interesting it was, really.
Exactly.
I guess you have to try and find the interesting part for your audience.
Well, it seems to have worked.
Yeah, but, really good book.
Yes.
Yep. Okay, well, before we sign off and get to feedback, I'd just like to remind our listeners of all the wonderful and appreciated ways you can support True Crime Brewery. You can join Team Tie Grabber, if you haven't yet, for as little as $2 a month. And you might be asking yourself, how do we provide this well-researched and entertaining content for so little money? Well, it's a matter of numbers, really. The more people who join, the less we need per listener. So it's simple math, right? I mean, you're the math guy. Well, what's that theory called?
I don't know.
Is it the theory of
diminishing quantity returns?
The theory of quantity over quality, or I don't know. There's a math.
If you say so.
Yeah, a mathematician out there will know.
Okay.
And anyway, so if you
send
join.
Send us that on feedback, math people.
Yeah. Now, if you join, we're going to send you a gift. And then, just to put some frosting on that cake, we're going to give you unfettered access to members-only podcasts. And these are full-length episodes of True Crime Brewery without any ads or pleas like this one for support. Another thing you can do, which is mutually beneficial, is to shop the brewery at tiegrabber.com. Go ahead and get yourself a cool TCB t-shirt for the upcoming warm months, or get a snifter of your own to drink some of the delicious beers that Dick turns you on to with his gravelly, smoldering voice.
Who wrote this?
Now, finally, for no cost at all, you can click Shop Amazon and Support True Crime Brewery on tiegrabber.com to buy stuff you were going to buy anyway, and Amazon will give us a percentage of their profits from your purchase. Also, we're always happy to get 5-star reviews, and we'll thank you on the podcast. And that helps us spread the word about TCB and bring in some new listeners. And just a reminder, get your feedback in to be featured on our next episode by emailing us at truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com, or you can leave us a voicemail on our website. You can also follow us on Instagram, Tiegrabber Podcasts, or on Twitter at Tiegrabber Pods, or on Facebook, tiegrabber.com/Facebook. However you choose to support the podcast, we thank you, and also thank you for listening.
Very much. We appreciate every day people that listen to us.
Absolutely. Now just a little musical interlude, and we'll be back with feedback.
Okay. Got some good stuff today.
Someone walking, someone talking, someone stopping.
Welcome to Feedback. So I'm going to start with an update on the Kelsey Schelling case from the episode Expectations, The Disappearance of Kelsey Schelling. Now, just a reminder, Kelsey disappeared in February of 2013, shortly after finding out she was pregnant. She drove to Pueblo to see her boyfriend and the father of her baby, Dante Lucas, and she was never seen again. Now, police had found video footage of Dante using Kelsey's ATM card, so he's been the primary and basically the only suspect. Now, Mark from Colorado forwarded an article to us from Westword on April 17th about the police uncovering items that are potential evidence during an excavation behind the former house of Dante Lucas, where he used to live. And the search was extensive. It actually included the removal of a tree, and paper and plastic bags were carried away by investigators. But they made it clear that they didn't find a body. Now, they haven't offered any specifics about what they did find, and there's still a $50,000 reward for Kelsey's location or return. Now, if you know anything, please call Pueblo Crime Stoppers at 719-542-7867. So I remember this case well.
Yeah, we were pretty convinced that her boyfriend, fiance, father of the child, whatever moniker you want to put on him, that he's guilty.
Yeah, and there was also a lot of suspicion about his family helping to cover it up, remember?
No question.
So I wonder about that. But it's encouraging to see that they're still looking into it.
Yeah, well, it sounds like they found some evidence and they're going to be pursuing things further.
Sounds like it, yep.
So
that's good. We'll keep on top of that. What have you got?
I got some feedback on Munchausen by proxy, the Lacey Spears story. I've got three notes. First is Kayla Burns on YouTube. She says, after watching the Dateline show, it's obvious she has a mental illness. She's very defensive and is trying too hard to convince people she's innocent. Posting pictures and updates clearly shows she feeds off of the attention of others. It's like she's addicted to the attention she gets. Her early life shows her mental illness forming. Now I'm off the fence and believe she's guilty and definitely needs help, which unfortunately she won't get in prison. She is definitely where she needs to be, though, and I'm sure she'll get jailhouse justice from the ladies who hate child killers.
Well, they were putting salt on her food. I know that.
Right. And then just a little afterward, by the way, this bitch needs to be charged with harming those other children. Why haven't the mothers pressed charges against her for the ear infections?
Yeah. She really damaged those kids' ears. Sounds like she was poking pins in them.
No question.
Ugh, horrible. Yeah. But I don't know what kind of justice they're going to get. I mean, she's in prison for life.
Yeah.
I guess they could sue her, but I don't think she has anything.
No, she doesn't. And I'm shuffling papers. Sorry. But I think we've talked about this, too, that she's in prison. She's not going to get the mental health care that she needs.
Probably not, no. But, you know, she won't get pregnant in there, hopefully. So.
Not that we know of.
Well, I mean, we haven't heard of it, and hopefully it's not going to happen. There aren't a lot of men around.
Well, there's those guards.
Yeah, they're not supposed to be impregnating prisoners.
Right.
Plus, she's cray-cray.
She really is.
Yeah.
And then I have another one about Munchausen from Historian Swag. Watching my kids have a toothache is excruciating. How could a parent intentionally ever cause their child harm? I'd rather be dead than cause my kids pain. This is so far removed from anything I could even comprehend.
Yeah, so explain that to us, doctor.
Explain what?
How could a mother do that?
She's mentally ill.
Yes.
That's the quick and simple explanation.
Well, I know, but I mean,
there's plenty. A whole complicated thing in terms of getting the attention that she craves.
I understand it's about attention, but why use her child to get attention? I mean, it seems almost like she got pregnant to get attention. The whole thing has been...
You use a child because you get more sympathy with a child.
Right, but before she had children, she would pretend she had ailments, and then she babysat children and gave them ailments.
Right.
So it's a thing she's had from way back.
It is. But at the same time, when she was presenting herself as having these ailments, she wasn't getting sufficient notice.
Right.
So, again, you have a child, and the child is sick, so you have sympathy for the sick child, and you're talking about how brave the mother is for taking care of the sick child. There's a lot of secondary gain.
But there's a big piece missing of empathy for your own child. How does that slip through the cracks?
Then we're back to what I said first. She's mentally ill.
Okay. That's all you're going to give me.
That's all.
Well, it is, I understand. Who wrote that?
That's historian swag.
Oh, okay. I totally understand. That's hard to relate to as a mother, totally. Really hard to understand. Although with her, you definitely see a very clear history of it all.
Yeah, you do, from early on.
Right. Okay. So also I've got from Nona on YouTube, I've got regarding buried secrets, the victims of Todd Kohlhepp. And Nona says, I'm not sure what state you're talking about, but you are very wrong about gun shows and being able to buy a gun. He may have been able to buy a gun from a citizen, but not from a gun dealer. So please correct that statement. Well, Nona, here's what I could find. So I looked this up because it's been a while since we did the episode, but he did have a felony conviction. So as a convicted felon who was on the sex offender registry, Kohlhepp shouldn't have owned a gun. But authorities said that they found numerous weapons, including 9mm handguns with silencers, assault rifles, and even an unbelievable amount of ammunition on his property. So Don Wood, a spokesman for the FBI in South Carolina, said that those guns apparently did not come from a licensed firearms dealer, which we know that because that would require a background check.
Exactly.
So the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check System does not have a record for the name of Todd Christopher Kohlhepp in relation to purchase a firearm. So that's to say it doesn't appear that his name was presented to NCIS for a background check by a federal firearms licensee. So he didn't apply for a license. So he did buy them illegally or under the table or something. So for many who buy guns, they go to a local gun store, and prior to their purchase, they fill out paperwork for an instant background check by the FBI. The FBI then searches the name in its databases for disqualifying factors, such as the felony conviction or a conviction for domestic violence. Now, if a conviction is found, the FBI can halt the purchase. If it needs more time to look at the records, the store must wait for up to 3 days. Now, asked recently by the Greenville News how Kohlhepp acquired the guns, which by law he was not supposed to have, Lieutenant Kevin Bobo, a spokesman for the Spartanburg County Sheriff's Office, said, "That's a good question." But gun buyers are not limited to buying guns from a gun store. They can also purchase or receive them from family, friends, gun shows, which is what we talked about as a loophole, right?
Right.
Or even over the internet or Craigslist.
Yeah, there's plenty of opportunity.
Right. So just to remind everyone, he was convicted in Arizona back in 1987 of kidnapping in connection with the rape of a 14-year-old neighbor when he was only 15. So according to court records, he used his father's handgun, which he took out of his truck for that crime. And when police came to talk to him about it, they said he had a rifle. So I guess what I'm saying is that he could have bought the gun at a gun show on the internet or online through Craigslist.
Yes.
Yeah, because those who knew him as a teenager and as an adult said he had a very fondness. He had a big fondness for guns, loved guns. But the authorities have not said where the guns confiscated from his property came from or how he acquired them.
Well, he probably acquired them in different ways.
So Nona said gun shows, you can't buy a gun. Well, I think that you can buy a gun from a gun show.
Right.
Right? Isn't that what they're saying?
That's what they said.
Okay. Maybe there are certain gun shows that have licensed firearms dealers where you can't, but you can buy one from just an individual.
Sure you can.
Right. Okay. Well, that clarifies that.
Yes, it does. Then I have one. This is from Tom. It's also on YouTube. It's regarding the mother on death row, the murders of Damon and Devin Rudier.
We've heard a lot about that one lately.
We have. And we've heard about possibly more involvement with her husband and so on. But
Right.
This was a very good thing to hear for me. Tom says the reason why they charged Darley with only one count, with only one of the murders, is because only one of the sons was under the age of 6, which is an aggravating circumstance that makes you eligible for the death penalty. So the older son's murder wasn't death penalty eligible. And that's why she got charged with the way she got charged.
Okay. So, but don't you think they were still reserving the other one and just in case she didn't get convicted of that one?
Possibly.
Because why couldn't they still have charged her with both and she could have got the death penalty because of one of them, I would think.
I don't know.
Not sure how that works, but that's a good point.
It's a very good point.
Okay.
You want some more, or do you have one?
I can do one. I have an email from Lisa Veal. We've had some back and forth about Michael Peterson, and this one's about Michael Peterson's recent interview. So this is puzzling to me, and that's why I'm bringing it up. I'm hoping you or one of our listeners can explain it to me. But she says that she did see the Dateline interview, and it stirred up emotions with her, and that she thinks he's very consistent with his guilt. And she says, as for those kids that I know you're impressed with, the boys seem great, but Margaret and Martha are quite simply nuts. Now, here's the puzzling part. If you've ever listened to the Gordon Lightfoot song, Sundown, it says it all. So you know the song, Sundown, I think it's a shame. That I picked up the lyrics on Google.
Okay.
So it's, I see her lying back in her satin dress in a room where you do what you don't confess. Sundown, you better take care if I find you've been creeping round my back stairs. Sundown, you better take care if I find you've been creeping round my back stairs. She's been looking like a queen in a sailor's dream, and she don't always say what she really means. Sometimes I think it's a shame when I get feeling better when I'm feeling no pain. Sometimes I think it's a shame when I get feeling better when I'm feeling no pain. I can picture every move that a man could make. Getting lost in her lovin' is your first mistake. Sundown, you better take care if I find you've been creepin' round my back stairs. So all I could think, does she mean something about him in the stairs? Because when I first read it, I thought she was talking about Margaret and Martha. Doesn't it sound that way in the email?
It started out that way, but maybe she's talking about the death of their mother.
Oh, okay. About their mother being round the back stair?
Right.
Okay, so you don't think it has to do with Margaret and Martha? Because I almost thought, Margaret and Martha, is she trying to say that he did something to them?
I'm just...
That he's a creeper with them or something?
That, to me, that's a confusing letter.
All right, well, Lisa's going to have to get back to me again. We've had some back and forth, and we disagree about the Michael Peterson case, but otherwise, we really respect each other.
Well, I hope so.
Yeah. So, all right, Lisa, this is what I got from your email. Explain yourself. Please.
Okay.
Okay. What have you got?
Well, I have a couple more on Deadly Greed, the murders of Carol and Christopher Stewart. Remember, this is Charles Stewart, the...
Oh, huge Boston case, yeah.
Right. Successful businessman who murdered his wife and unborn child and shot himself.
Jumped off a bridge.
And then eventually jumped off a bridge.
Oh, shot himself at the crime scene.
At the crime scene.
Gotcha.
So first one is from Despite All My Rage, and this is on YouTube.
Okay.
Okay. Not to be too blunt here, but Chuck was absolutely positively, without a doubt, fucking Debbie. Now, Debbie is...
the first store girl
that he worked with. Like a protege or something. Maybe not a protege.
I think they just worked together.
She was doing summer employment with him.
Something. They worked at that first store together.
So why she would deny it isn't much of a mystery as far as I'm concerned. The guy was a racist killer whom everyone hated.
Sure.
He was married and they were expecting their first child, and not to mention Debbie had a boyfriend of her own. So it's understandable why she would completely deny any involvement with that piece of shit.
Sure, I don't blame Debbie for that.
Well, no.
I mean, she probably shouldn't have been screwing around with him, but in the movie that was with Ken Olin, the Lifetime movie about it, I think it was a Lifetime movie, She wasn't really interested in him. She was kind of avoiding him.
Yeah.
But that's just the movie, so who knows?
Well, he was a charming guy. Chuck was.
He could be, I guess. But so, the whole city of Boston wasn't very charmed with him once they figured him out.
No.
No.
So then I have another one about the same murders from Christy on YouTube. So she says, or he says, I'm going to say she. Another super interesting case on this same subject and very interesting is the case of Perry and Janet March in Nashville, Tennessee. This case was such a soap opera and took the investigation through other states and all the way to Mexico for 10 years. When Perry is finally brought to trial for his wife's murder, her body has never been found. Like many of the others, they appeared to be the perfect couple. He was a lawyer, she an artist, and they lived in a large, beautiful home in the wealthy part of town. Janet grew up in Belle Meade, probably the most prestigious community of Tennessee. Went to the best schools. Just a little bit of the drama. Perry's own mother died under very suspicious circumstances decades before. And his father, who many suspected of being responsible for his wife's murder, finally admitted to helping his son dispose of Janet's body.
Wow.
Twisted family.
I guess so.
But looks can be deceiving. Perry lived a whole other life, and obviously his years of secrets were exposed the night his wife disappeared. You won't believe his secrets. I suggest covering this case here, as it is so intriguing. You got my interest.
Yeah, okay.
So, Christy, we're going to look into this.
Where was that from?
Nashville.
Oh, okay.
So I think it'd be worth taking a peek at and see if we want to do it.
We can do that. We'll take a look.
Okay.
All right. So that's it for feedback.
I don't got no more feedback.
All right. Well, keep the feedback coming. We're really enjoying it.
You bet.
All right. And until next time we see you at the Quiet End, take care of each other.
We'll save a seat for you.
Okay.
And a couple Molsons.
Nah, we'll have a different beer.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.